You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Over the year, our legislatures and our California Supreme Court have taken a look at the nuts and bolts of the way courts determine who's going to remain in custody and under what conditions people might be released while they're pending trial, resolving their criminal cases. And tonight, we take a look at our system, a system based around cash bail. Tonight's topic is our system of bail, what's right and what's wrong. Should we still have a cash bail system? If we abolish it, what would a successor program look like? If we maintain it, is there a way to fix our current system? If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134 in the studio. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And you don't need to jump into exactly where we may be in our discussions. If you have a question about bail, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. With me tonight, we're very fortunate to have with us Jay Boyarsky, Chief Assistant District Attorney from Santa Clara County. That's the largest county in our region. Garrett Retkers from Redwood City. Mr. Retkers is a certified criminal law specialist from the State Bar of California Board of Legal Specialization. And BJ Fadum, with offices in San Jose and Santa Rosa. Mr. Fadum is a certified family law specialist, also from the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. Now, we know BJ from his family law practice. He's here often, and we always appreciate the time he spends with us. But long ago, in another life, and that is a life before the practice of law, BJ worked both at the San Jose Police Department and later in pretrial services. And the role of pretrial services is going to be a pretty important factor in our discussions tonight. We talk about pretrial services, but just what do they do? And we'll talk about that momentarily. So if you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us, again, right here in the studio, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local area, again, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And with that, let me welcome each of you. BJ, Jay, Garrett, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for having us, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
You know, I'd like to start here. You know, where did all this start? Who can tell us about the early history of bail and just where it got started from?
Well, I can jump in. Jeff, bail goes back to England in 410 all the way through the year 1066, you know, the time of Beowulf. And the idea of money bail was a means of settling disputes peacefully. When people were having a dispute with one another, they'd find someone who could prove that a person could put up the amount of money necessary to settle the dispute once the settlement was reached. And that slowly over really hundreds of years is what turned into bail in the criminal law.
So it seems almost as though it developed from an undertaking, a guarantee that our civil issues are going to be resolved and I'll put up so much money to guarantee my place. But out with...
Yeah, that's right. And Massachusetts in 1641 had a law about no person shall be restrained or imprisoned if he can put in sufficient security, bail, or main prize for his appearance. I don't know what main prize is, but I know what bail is. And then, of course, people are familiar with the Eighth Amendment of the Bill of Rights, and that prohibits excessive bail. And so that takes us into the United States history. And an interesting fact is the first commercial bail bond business is from the 1890s, right here in San Francisco. It was the McDonough Brothers Bail Bond Company. Peter and Thomas McDonough started the first bail bond firm inside their father's saloon, right near the San Francisco Hall of Justice. it was shut down in 1912 due to massive corruption, but the McDonough brothers were allowed to keep their liquor license.
Well, sense of priorities.
Exactly.
So, let's go to more modern times. I guess you brought up the Eighth Amendment. Have we gotten some... I mean, does that apply to the states, or do the states have a lot of say about what they're going to do with bail?
Well, it applies to the states, and then California has its own constitution, and Article 1, Section 12 of the California Constitution talks about when someone is allowed to post bail, and that bail is a right. And Article 1, Section 28 talks about public safety bail. And a person, it says a person may be released on bail by sufficient sureties, except for capital crimes, when the facts are evident or the presumption great. Excessive bail may not be required. And it sort of goes on from there. And it's in this context that the whole bail industry in California sprung up, and it's been with us for a very long time. But as I'm sure you're going to talk about, that industry is now dramatically changed, some would say eliminated, with the passage of Senate Bill 10.
And we'll talk about that. Right now, I think that they're still in existence, and in many ways, they're a pretty powerful force. But before we talk about the bail industry, let's talk a little bit about procedures and what the court does and how the court sets bail. And it seems to me, with your background, B.J. Fathom, you may have some real answers for us there.
Well, I think it starts actually even before you get to the courtroom. So my job under pretrial release was to determine, and I worked the graveyard shift at the jail, so I got the best of the times, but it was for us to interview the perpetrator who was just arrested to determine whether or not they were going to be released on their own recognizance and report back. That was done through, at least in Santa Clara County, it was done through the probation department, which was the pretrial release program. At that time, and again, this was a previous lifetime when I was one of my other careers, we did what we call a five-point system. And it was to determine, essentially, were they a flight risk? Do they have ties to the community? And it was to determine whether or not we can guarantee that they were going to show up for their court appearance. And so we would have to go and interview each of the defendants at some point as to whether or not they fulfill the requirements, and could they be released at that time on their own recognizance, or are they going to be reported? And then the court would decide whether or not they were going to set bail and how much.
Was that before the court was considering public safety as a factor?
Public safety was a consideration, so it had to do with what crime was committed and whether or not you were even eligible for own recognizance release. So these were pretty much the defendants that were arrested for property crimes, things to that effect. If it was a felony, it was going to go into the main system, and you're going to get a bail schedule through the court.
So can you address, since you were also a police officer, the difference between an arrest, a booking charge, and what goes on with pretrial services concurrent with what's going on with the prosecutor's office in evaluating an arrest to determine whether they'll file charges?
And that's a good question. So from what I saw, as the police officer, and I would go and arrest, and I would go and process through the booking. Obviously, at that point, I don't know yet whether or not the district attorney's office is going to issue a complaint. All I know is I'm going to package up my report and submit it. So they're going to go ahead and get booked and processed. Depending upon what that charge is, and again, if it's a property or it's not a danger to the public type of crime, it's not a felony, then when I was pretrial release, I would interview and decide, are you going to be released on your own recognizance? And that would occur before they would even have an indictment or any kind of a complaint filed.
Right. So this is the reason I brought this up is I do criminal defense work, and I'm constantly getting questions from clients or assurances from clients' families as to what the charges are. And usually at that point, the charges are still pending with the prosecutor's office, and pretrial services are making decisions, and the police have made decisions on booking. But whether or not the charges will actually be filed, that really rests with the prosecutor and the prosecutor alone.
And what charges those are. Many times I would arrest on certain charges, submit the report. That doesn't mean that that's the charges that the district attorney is going to issue.
Right. And so I wanted to bring this up because, as we've sort of referenced, bail setting is really driven by prosecutorial decisions as to what is actually going to be brought by way of complaint or sometimes grand jury, but that's a different issue.
For the most part, when the police arrest somebody on a charge where that charge could have been a misdemeanor or could have been a felony, what guidance do the police have on what to book?
A lot of it, we have what we call the wobblers, but it's going to be based upon, as a police officer, you have to have the reasonable cause. What are you arresting them on? That may not be the ultimate charge, but at the time. So we all go through our post-academy. That's, you know, the police officer's academy, and we do have criminal law that we have to learn. But I can tell you, having been a police officer before being a lawyer, obviously, there's a huge difference as far as the knowledge. And so it's a matter of just learning the code sections as best you can, making the arrest based upon what you believe you have as far as what the reasonable evidence is and what it shows. But again, there are many times, and we all know it because I do some criminal defense and I've done it more in the past, we'll come with our clients at the arraignment date and there's still no complaint filed, and there may not be. And so whether or not they've posted bail or they've been released on their own recognizance, and it may never, ever have been filed.
Right, right. So, and again, that's a decision with the prosecutor. Sometimes do you find that prosecutors are asking the police for additional information before they'll make a decision on filing?
When I was a police officer, and again, I'm going to age myself because it was a while ago, we would package up our report first, and it goes to our watch commander, our sergeant. And there were many, many times, I can tell you, that our report, our package, before it went to the district attorney's office, was sent back to us with particular pointers from our watch commander as to, you know, you've got some holes in your report. And then once it finally would go through, there were a couple of times that we would get a kickback from the district attorney because it is missing some points, and the watch commander would give it back to us. There were only a couple of times I would have the actual district attorney's office contact me directly asking further information to determine whether or not they were going to file.
So how much say do the police department or the arresting officer, how much say would you say that they have in terms of telling the prosecutors what charges to bring?
I don't think they have that much discretion or authority on what charges to bring, as opposed to this is what I've got and this is what I can essentially give you and prove. And then it's up to the DA. I don't know if things have changed, and maybe Jay can pipe in a little bit more on that. But when I was doing it, I don't think I had much authority other than, I would say for the most part, especially the simple arrests, whatever we arrested somebody for, that's – if the charges were going to go through, that's the charges that the district attorney was going to go ahead and issue.
Okay. I would say that you know, it's interesting when you talk about how much authority do the police have. Well, the police have immense authority. They're taking someone into custody, and then they're giving all the information they have about the case to us at the DA's office. So everything we're doing is based exclusively on what we're being told by the police. So the police have a great deal of power and discretion, because they control all the information at that point in time. And so we get the, you know, it's we get the police reports, and if there's no question about what the offense was and the police are telling us what the evidence is, then it's often a very straightforward decision. You know, this person went into a store and shoplifted and took this, and we're going to file a misdemeanor shoplifting charge. But if it's a bar fight and the police report says that someone, a victim was injured, let's say they were hit over the head, hopefully the police report is going to say, were they transported to the hospital? Did they need stitches? Did they lose consciousness? That's the kind of information the prosecutors need to know right away to decide how serious is this assault. Is it a felony that caused great bodily injury? That would be one type of crime to charge. Or is it a misdemeanor battery that didn't result in a serious injury? You don't even need an injury for a battery. And so those are the kind of decisions that prosecutors are making every day based solely on what's in the police report. And that has a direct impact on what the amount of bail is going to be.
Before we go further, we're going to tonight talk about what's right with bail, what's wrong with bail, what alternative systems we're looking at. But before we go any further, Jay, you brought up a seminal point that I think we need to talk about at some length, which is somebody doesn't get OR'd. They're going to court for the first time. What procedure does the court typically use to determine how much bail to set?
There's 58 counties in California, and every single county has their own bail schedule where the judge will look and see what the defendant is charged with by the district attorney. Let's say it is a residential burglary felony, and the judge will look at the bail schedule that is set up by a committee of judges in that county and say, and make that the bail that's set. Let's say it's $10,000 bail. Then the defense attorney and the prosecutor have the ability to argue that the bail should be higher, lower, or that the person should be released on their own recognizance and no bail should be required.
So, Jay, those bail schedules are set solely by the charges?
All the different charges have a different amount of bail set for them.
But the decisions that are made in terms of the initial setting of bail or the presumptive bail is based off the actual charges, correct?
The charges that the district attorney has filed.
So doesn't that give the prosecutors too much power in terms of setting charges and knowing that certain charges are going to draw higher bail than others, and maybe they think a particular defendant is dangerous for whatever reason, and so they overcharge?
Well, remember, when anybody is held on an arrest warrant, it's because an officer has taken the facts to the district attorney, and then a judge has reviewed the statement of probable cause and determined that that specific crime has been committed. So if someone commits a burglary, the DA can't come in and say this is really a murder case and ask that they be held for murder when there's no dead body and there was no murder that was ever committed. Oh. But if the question is, don't prosecutors have a great deal of power and authority? Yes, they do, absolutely.
So as an example, you mentioned a shoplifting case. Couldn't you also perhaps charge that person with receiving stolen property as a felony for the beef jerky that they walk away with?
Well, it depends on the value of the property. You can't do that in California anymore. But perhaps more to your point is, if you go in and steal a pack of gum from a store, that's a misdemeanor petty theft. However, if a prosecutor can prove that you entered a commercial establishment or a home, and before you entered, you had a plan to steal, well, that is a felony. That's a burglary. And then you get into the question of, well, what was the amount of the loss?
Jay, I'm glad you brought that up, because we ran into that both as a police officer, and then one of the other jobs I did at the same time was working security, retail security. And we would have the professional shoplifters come in, and a lot of times that's exactly how we charged it, because you can show the intent where they came with the apparatus to shoplift. We would charge them with burglary as opposed to shoplifting.
Right.
So I do have a question in a moment. I'd like to all three of you think about this. One of the things I noticed from my own practice I'm based out of Redwood City, but I do get up to San Francisco. More often, I get down to Palo Alto and into San Jose, occasionally into the East Bay. And one of the things I've noticed is that as I go from place to place, the bail schedules vary a lot. And it's not that one county is uniformly high and another county is uniformly low, but it seems that within each county, they have their own sense of priorities, the things that offend them as a community. And it's really reflected in the bail schedule. So I'm going to pose a question about that in a moment, and if there's a way to fix that. But before I do, to our listeners out there, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco, where we are discussing our system of bail. What's right? What's wrong? In the studio with me tonight, we have BJ Fathom, who has law offices in San Jose and Santa Rosa. We know BJ as an expert in family law, but long ago in another life, he had a history working with the San Jose Police Department and later in pretrial services. And also in the studio with me tonight is Garrett Rutgers of Redwood City, a certified criminal law specialist certified by the Board of Legal Specialization at the State Bar of California. And on the phone with me tonight is Jay Boyarsky. Jay is the Chief Assistant District Attorney of Santa Clara County, the largest county in our region, and an expert in all things criminal law, responsible for the day-to-day operations of an office of 600 public servants, including 190 prosecutors. If you have questions tonight about bail, you don't have to jump into the conversation exactly where we are. We're about to talk about varying from county to county, and we may be talking about other stuff. Any questions you have for my guests, any bail-related questions, call in. The number in the studio, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you are calling from outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free. We'll pick up the freight. The number here, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Before we break, I did want to talk about the variances between counties and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing and whether there might be some adjustment in order there. Who would like to pick that question up?
Well, Jeff, can I jump in and talk about that?
Absolutely.
You make an excellent point about how it varies from county to county, and I think that question illustrates why the current cash bail system is broken. And that's because it's based on cash, which can vary from county to county and obviously from person to person, and it's not based on safety. So recently, a man was arrested for sexually assaulting two victims in Santa Clara County. And over a prosecutor's objection, he was given a $1.75 million bail and was released. 6 months later, while awaiting trial, he was arrested for another rape. In another case, a mentally ill man was killed by jail guards in Santa Clara County while he was in jail, in part because he lacked the ability to come up with $16,000 bail, or actually 10% of that, even $1,600 bail. So the issue of cash and bail, it's an outdated system. It needs to be based on risk to public safety and not how much money someone has. It's all about having the appropriate people detained and not simply poor people detained because they can't afford bail, or wealthy people who own a home or have access to property who are dangerous but are released because they can come up with the money.
And I would agree with Jay, and I see this a lot in the crossover with domestic violence. We see it. Domestic violence occurs at the high end. These very wealthy people are some very dangerous domestic violence perpetrators. They can post the bail, and they're released, whereas, as Jay was saying, somebody that may be picked up for shoplifting or petty theft can't come up with a small amount of bail. But we've seen it where it's happened over and over again. The high earner or high assets can easily bail themselves out from a heinous domestic violence arrest and then go out, and then we've had the issues, they've attacked the victim again. We see it from family court, and I see it from the criminal defense cases I do.
So beyond just the issue of the disparity in bail and disparity of certain individuals from different backgrounds' ability to make the bail, what we also should be recognizing is the conviction rates vary depending on pretrial release as well. Oftentimes, especially for low-level misdemeanors, prosecutors will come in and offer somebody credit for time served. I'm discussing this with my client. You know, he didn't do it, but he really wants to get out of custody, and they'll bite the bullet and do the no contest plea. They're not admitting guilt, but they just really need to go home. They need to make livings for their families. And that's how you wind up with the disparate conviction rates that you see as well.
One of the things you reminded me of just now, years ago, as a public defender in Los Angeles County, and I'm going back a quarter century, a young public defender named Jeffrey Crowther came up to me and asked me to complete the sentence. Let me explain to you why you should not accept this time-served offer. And time-served, of course, meant the person's getting out. And we were talking about a particular case, and he said that and left it hanging. And I don't believe at that time I completed that sentence. It's very difficult when somebody's in custody to turn down the ability to return to their life when you have consequences which, at least at that point in time, appear to be fairly minimal. The problem is that people sometimes get themselves boxed in, and later on in life, these things close in on them, and maybe they regret having pled to something where they would have maybe not been legally guilty, maybe not factually guilty, but it seemed the thing to do to get out.
Right. And convictions carry all kinds of consequences down the line for people that they may not recognize because they're so desperate to come home. They've got records now. Prosecutors review that if they come into the system again. Now, they're charged with prior convictions. You're certainly going to be on some form of probation. You're probably giving up your right to be left alone, so you're going to be searched. You're going to be looked at more closely than you otherwise might be looked at. And it may be that if you could have posted bond, your attorney would have had more time to review the case, investigations could have been conducted, information provided to prosecutors, charges reduced and or dismissed. The bail has outcomes. It drives cases.
And prosecutors only want to convict guilty people. They do not want to convict someone who is innocent. We know that people who are charged with a crime will sometimes say that they're innocent when in fact they're guilty. And I have no quarrel with what I think it was Garrick was saying, is that there are some people who are adamant and will say, but I didn't do this, but I can't come up with bail, but I'll plead no contest just so I can go home. No ethical prosecutor ever wants anyone to be in that situation. And that's a glaring example of why decisions about who remains in custody pending charges or not needs to be based on a threat assessment, a risk assessment based on data and good judgment from accountable professionals, and not just based on whether someone is rich or poor.
And Jay, one thing that undoubtedly you've experienced, and I can tell you from the defense side of the bar, we've experienced as well, is the idea of going to trial and starting out the trial with one view, whether your client is truly innocent or guilty. You may doubt their story, but they have an absolute constitutional right to trial. And as you air it out, you find out, no, they are not guilty. Or similarly, you go out to trial, and this happens more often, unfortunately, as you have a client where you truly believe in their innocence. And as you get further along and the facts start coming out, you start to realize, I'm not so sure. We don't know that with 100% certainty at any stage, but it certainly looks a lot more certain after it's aired out. And the idea of somebody entering into a plea before that because they didn't have money for bail is something that I think we can all agree is a really unfortunate situation when it's...
Right. People are not supposed to be held people are not supposed to be punished until they're convicted. They shouldn't be deprived of their liberty before they've been convicted because we have a presumption of innocence in this country. However, you should be able to keep someone in custody if they're going to get out and go right out and sexually assault the victim or beat up their wife again. That's that's sort of the issue of bail. You want them to come back to court. Think of bail, the current cash bail system, as like an anchor on a boat. You want the bail to be the anchor to keep someone in the community and come back to court, but it shouldn't be an anchor, if it's a little boat, an anchor that's going to swamp the dinghy. And likewise, if it's a big, huge cruise ship, you shouldn't have a little tiny anchor that's not going to have any effect on the person. There's another thing that the flip side of the coin of cash bail and people pleading guilty and to resolve their cases and going home. Senate Bill 10, this new system it looks like we're moving to, if it's going to lead to more people being out of custody with all the expected fairness and the cost savings of not keeping unsentenced people pre-trial in jail, if it's going to lead to those benefits, if you guys as criminal defense lawyers know that people who are in custody are more likely to accept a plea bargain at some point in time because the day of reckoning is there that day. They're in custody. If you have people who are charged with crimes who are out of custody, they may want to prevent that day of reckoning or postpone it. And that is something that could lead to longer delays in the criminal justice system.
I got to hit the pause button for just a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We've been discussing our system of bail and what's right about it and what's wrong with it. I'm Jeff Hayden. With us tonight on the air, we're fortunate to have Jay Boyarsky, the Chief Assistant District Attorney out of Santa Clara County. BJ Fadham, we all know him as an expert in family law with offices in San Jose and Santa Rosa. But again, before practicing law, BJ was both a police officer and then worked for pretrial services, knows a lot about what we're discussing, about how releases are attained, on what circumstances. And Garrett Rutgers, a certified criminal law specialist from the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. If you have questions for my guests, the phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local area, if you're calling from outside of San Francisco, let us pay the freight. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And again, you're not limited to the exact point in the discussion. Any questions about bail, where it's been, where it's going, what's right, what's wrong, any questions about bail, call us, 866-798-8255. We've been talking about some of the problems with the current system. And, Jay, I want to give you a chance to circle back and finish your thought before we move on.
Well, I was saying that if people are out of custody pre-trial, one of the unintended consequences, I think, of bail reform is that it could lead to delay and the amount of time it takes to resolve a criminal case. And there's age... criminal cases are typically not like wine. Age does not make them better. Evidence gets old, memories fade, victims have a right to see the perpetrators held accountable, suspects have a right to confront the evidence that is going to be used against them. But typically when someone charged with a crime is out of custody, they have a great deal of control over the clock and whether they waive time or choose not to waive time, meaning extend the amount of time before they demand their jury trial. And if people are out of custody, they may be inclined to try to extend the amount of time the cases take. So if Senate Bill 10 is eventually implemented, and if it leads to a higher number of people being out of custody pending charges, one consequence could be that cases take a lot longer, and that could have a lot of big consequences on our criminal justice system.
Before we circle back to what is SB 10, and I'm going to give you a chance to explain that to folks that are listening, and we do have a couple calls that are working their way through, so I think we may be circling around a bit. But, Jay, you mentioned that if SB 10 results in a lot of people getting released, but is there any reason to think that after SB 10 passes, assuming it becomes law, and that is an assumption that we're not quite there yet, but assuming it does become law, isn't it likely that the result of SB 10 will be just like the result of a bail schedule now? In some places, it means a lot more people may be getting out. In other places, it might mean a lot more people are staying in.
I don't have a crystal ball, but based on following the legislation as it moved through the system, I think it means that that fewer people are going to be detained. It's going to abolish cash bail. When it comes to misdemeanors, and misdemeanors are about 80% of criminal cases in California, almost all of those misdemeanors are going to be cited and released within 12 hours under SB 10. Now, there'll be greater scrutiny as the seriousness of the offense increases with felonies, but the detention is going to be based on risk and not lack of money. So, you know, it remains to be seen what the impact of SB 10 will be, but I'm an optimist, and I consider myself a criminal justice reformer. I have to think that the result of SB 10 will be a better situation than we have now under cash bail. And I mean better for everyone, more fair and more just, which is the goal we should all have.
And with that, we have a couple callers in the line. Let me first turn to Mark in San Francisco. Mark, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have a question here. My legal rights, I've had several assaults in my building here, and the police keep letting them go. And I was just wondering, are they liable for this? Can I sue them?
And by them, do you mean the police?
Yes, sir.
Jeff, you're looking at me like I think I should take this one. The police officers are cloaked with governmental immunity, and it's pretty much absolute. It's within the discretion of police officers. When we go to investigate a potential crime, we have to look at all the evidence. And the bottom line that you have to think about is what the district attorney thinks about, and I think Jay can voice on this. You have to prove under criminal law beyond a reasonable doubt. And do you have the evidence before you start arresting people, detaining them, and incarcerating? So, I mean, there are possibilities that you can file civil complaints. But as far as saying I'm going to sue the police officers, it's under very, very restricted conditions. Can you actually sue? Because you're going to be suing the city or the county of the law enforcement.
Okay. A short example is the last time I was assaulted in this building, I'm disabled. I have a lot of back trouble, and this guy owed me some money, and I was carrying my groceries up, and he assaulted me, and I could not defend myself because of the condition I'm in, so I was beat bloody. And the policeman came, and just like the time before, I told him what happened, and the cop came up and said that, he said the assaultant, he said something else. Now, what else could he say that where I'm be bloody and I have a hospital report?
Well, Mark, it's really off the topic of tonight's show, which is really about bail and pretrial release. I can tell you two things in answer to your question. The first is, for a police officer to lose that immunity, he pretty much has to, or she pretty much has to, be stepping outside of their role as a peace officer completely before there's any immunity. So for them to use excessive force might subject them to liability. For them to make a bad judgment call, probably not. My suggestion to you is to call back. We do periodically have attorneys in that are more involved in civil litigation. Probably a call you might want to save for one of those nights, and they can guide you with better emphasis on that.
Okay.
But I do appreciate your call, Mark, and thank you for joining us. Let me turn it over to Steve in Redwood City. Welcome. Is this my friend Steve in Redwood City?
Oh, well, that's a judgment call, but I think so, Jeff. Yes. Thanks for taking the call. It's a good. I'm interested in the show. I have a question for your expert, particularly Jay Boyarsky, because he's always right. And that is SB 10, as it went through the legislature, had the support of the state public defenders and the ACLU until the final version of the bill. They then withdrew their support as it finally worked its way through, on the basis that in the end it will incarcerate more people than are presently incarcerated. I'd like to hear the opinions of your experts on the show tonight as to whether they agree with that or not.
And feel free, Steve, I don't make this invitation often or lightly, but feel free to stay on the line as we discuss that. I'd like to circle back to you. But who would like to field that?
Whether more people are going to stay in custody?
Yeah, the fear of the, I believe it was the California Public Defenders Association, is that more people might stay. Perhaps, Steve, I would like to you just stay on the line. I'm going to pause that for a moment. Feel free to join in this answer to the question I'm going to pose. But we've talked a lot about SB 10. Who would like to field just what SB 10 is?
Well, I can tell you that Senate Bill 10 eliminates cash bail or bail bonds. And it says that if someone is going to be detained after being arrested, that decision needs to be based on risk, not how much money they have. And there's different levels of review. And then the nuts and bolts of Senate Bill 10 basically says that each individual county should develop a system of pretrial services where they can use what are called risk assessment tools. Sometimes, you know, they're called algorithms. And a fear is, so a decision about whether someone's going to be released is going to be just made by computer, by an algorithm. And Senate Bill 10 does not say that someone's release is going to be based on an algorithm. Senate Bill 10 always preserves the right of a judge, a human being, to override what the recommendation of the algorithm is. But what we want to avoid when we have judges making decisions is, of course, biases. And we want decisions to be made on facts and evidence and accurate risk. We don't want it to be made on misplaced fear or prejudices. Yet you always want to maintain the human element when it comes to making a professional judgment, and it needs to be made. The decisions need to be made by someone who's accountable. And in our system, at that point in time, it's really a judge.
Steve, you were here on the show with me a year ago when we had a very similar discussion. That was before SB 10. It was before the Supreme Court or the Chief Justice had a complete report from her Blue Ribbon Commission on what to do about bail. Do you agree with what Jay's analysis of SB 10?
I do, and that's why I supported SB 10, and the state district attorneys went and did not oppose SB 10 because it retained with judges that discretion. But that was the very reason that the state public defenders and the ACLU withdrew their support and said they would no longer support it because they did not want judges to have that, because they believe that would lead to an increase in incarceration, not a decrease, as everybody else thinks. And I'm curious to know what Jay and your guests think of that, Garrett and the others.
Well, me personally, I guess it would depend on the judge in particular, but I like to believe that our bench officers are generally fair. There are certainly some outliers. Some of the older judges are probably going to be reticent to be releasing people without cash bond, just simply because that's what they're used to doing. But I'm in support of some kind of an alternative to cash bail because of all the disparities that we've talked about. And I was surprised to hear, and this was news to me just now, that the public defenders came out against it. I was wondering why, and you guys addressed that. So if it just comes back to not trusting the judges, we're already trusting the judges. So I don't understand. I don't understand why everybody's hesitant to do so.
Well, let me jump in and answer that. A caller had called in earlier, left a question that they wanted read into the air rather than to stay on the line. And it seems like this goes right to what we're talking about. This caller said, can we really trust algorithms to make fair determinations or risk assessments, the factors that determine who gets released? Some critics are concerned about an inherent racial bias embedded in the data that may be used by the algorithms.
Well, I think part of that goes back to the point I was making earlier about potential conviction rates increasing, where you have folks who can't make bail and they're being offered, time served offers, go home, get back to your family, get back to work. And then, that gets back to communities of color and those kinds of disparities that this caller is worried about with the algorithm.
If I could jump in,
sure.
I would say no, you really don't want to, everyone should have a concern about whether we should trust an algorithm. And likewise, though, people should have concerns about whether we can trust the judgment of judges. Human beings are not perfect, and algorithms are also just created by human beings. They're not perfect either. But if algorithms are based on really good local data, and it's based on looking back over time at who has gone out and committed a crime for this specific offense when they met these 8 or 9 different criteria, and if it is done without regard to the person's race, their religion, then it becomes an effective tool. It's never going to be the only answer. Getting back to our caller Steve's question about whether SB 10 is going to lead to more people being detained or fewer people being detained, I think it's going to lead to fewer people being detained. In 2/3 of the people in jail in California, they're pre-sentenced. They haven't been convicted, and yet they're in jail at enormous financial and societal cost to their families. And the vast majority of criminal cases in California are misdemeanors. They're less serious crimes than felonies. So I think, just based on the numbers, fewer people will be detained. The good thing about Senate Bill 10, another good thing, if it's implemented appropriately, is that people who commit, those small numbers of people who commit extremely serious or violent crimes, even if they have access to money, and if someone owns a home in the Bay Area, they have a family that owns a home, they can put the home up, because real estate's so expensive here. Under the current cash bail system, you can have very dangerous people who can come up with large amounts of money and then get out and re-victimize. And Senate Bill 10, if it's implemented fairly, is going to say, we don't care that you're rich, we think you're dangerous based on the type of crime you committed and these other risk factors based on the risk assessment tool. That's the hope.
And I would agree with Jay. And I think what we have to do is go back to, it's almost a two-pronged test that bail was set for, is the danger to the public, but also the risk of flight by the defendant. And when you're looking at that, I think, unfortunately, inherently, we may have an issue with discriminatory application through the algorithms, just based on demographics. I mean, you're looking at employment. Do you have employment ties to the community, things to that effect? And just how do we avoid that? And then balancing it with still having the discretion of the judge to balance that off, it, as Garrick was saying, it depends on the judge. We try to have faith in our judges, and I think for the most part, at least the judges that I deal with on a daily basis, are always trying to do the best that they can. There's always going to be an inherent or implicit bias, and whether or not they're aware of it or not, and I think they try and avoid it when they are aware of it. And I don't know if there's a perfect system, but I think SB 10 is definitely working towards that.
And I agree with the comments made so far. My feeling is that we're probably better having both an algorithm and a human at the end of the process, i.e. a judge, looking at it. My concern with the algorithm is very likely the algorithm is going to take into account, on top of public safety issues and ties to the community, prior record. Every single algorithm I've looked at always includes prior record, prior performance on probation, things like that. And that's, again, one of those implicit bias issues, because so many people are, unfortunately, the focus of law enforcement based on where they live or how they appear. And as we've discussed earlier, many of those folks are poor, and many of those folks have pled guilty to charges simply to get out. Whether Jay agrees with that or not, I think that is, in fact, true. And there are cases where I've been able to extend my investigation and be able to provide information to the prosecutors that this case is not what you thought it was, and eventually get the case dismissed, where I wouldn't be able to do that, say, 5, 10, 20 days out and an offer is being made. It's just simply not possible, because from a defense perspective, we're always playing catch-up to the police investigation. We've got the case. It's already 5 days old. It's already happened. The police usually have done their investigation, or they're continuing it, and we're playing catch-up.
One last time, I'm going to mention, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We're discussing our system of bail, for better or for worse, where we are, where we're going. I'm Jeff Hayden. In the studio with me tonight, we have Jay Boyarsky, Chief Assistant District Attorney out of Santa Clara County. In the studio, we have Garrett Rutgers, a certified criminal law specialist with offices in Redwood City. B.J. Fathom. Mr. Fathom is known to us as an expert in family law, but in another life, he was working with pretrial services and with the San Jose Police Department. And on the phone with us tonight, we have District Attorney Steve Wagstaff, former president of the California District Attorneys Association, and a frequent guest on the show, currently the San Mateo County District Attorney. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. If you're calling toll-free, 866-798-8255.
If you'd like to make a
call. We lost. And it sounds like we lost Steve Wagstaff. Last chance, if you have a question for our guest, 866-798-8255. You have a few minutes to call in if you wish. Before we part, we're talking about a system with an algorithm or somebody making a decision, thumbs up, thumbs down. I wanted to ask about something very analogous to what we're talking about, and that is the system that's currently in play in juvenile court, where you don't have a right to bail. How do the algorithms work there? Garrett, I know you practice in both juvenile and adult.
I do. I've been doing juvenile defense work since 92. I can't speak to the history in the way Jay did with bail, but I can tell you that for quite some time in juvenile court, you're either in or you're out. It used to cause me great shock and horror when families would come into court and say, we're going to get a paid lawyer, and then the paid lawyer would come in and promptly make a motion for bail. You know, that sort of demonstrates their expertise right there in juvenile court. But no, judges do use algorithms in the juvenile court. Ties to the community with kids is sort of pre-exists. You know, they're dependent on their parents, and their ability to travel or flee jurisdictions is somewhat limited. But things that judges look at are, in fact, prior records, which I alluded to earlier with the adult system. Certainly, they look at the offense. Again, my concern there, oftentimes I see prosecutors, especially in juvenile court, I think they overcharge where they've got the option of charging a misdemeanor or a felony. More often than not, I find that they're charging felonies with the hope that the case will bargain out maybe at a misdemeanor level later, and knowing that more likely a kid is going to stay in custody if he's charged more severely. Other things that they look at are, it's sort of analogous to work history, is school performance, whether they're showing up at all, what kind of grades they get when they're there, any kind of teacher comments. Whether they're following mom or dad's rules, all of that. And then also, and I'm seeing this more and more, it's set up in the code, but in my experience was ignored for years. But the courts are starting to come around to what the research shows, and that's that pretrial detention, especially in excessive periods of time in custody, can actually be very harmful for a developing adolescent, and the judges really should take a close look at whether or not you want to put a kid in a incarcerated situation, especially in a population of other delinquents, and or whether you want to remove them from that system and look to other resources.
With that, I'm going to make that the last we hear on the subject, because I would like to give each of the three of you a minute or so for any closing thoughts you have, anything that you wish to add. Who would like to go first? I see a finger come from BJ. Would you like to jump in?
Okay, I was pointing to Jay, but I'll take it.
He couldn't see you.
So I think I'm all for SB10. I think if we're working in the right direction, we do need to change it, because as Jay and everybody here were discussing it, it is discriminatory as to how the bail system is affected. Is it perfect the way we are pursuing it? Maybe not, and it may need a little bit massaging over the years, which most of our laws have to do anyway. But I think if you take a look at some of the other states that have already gotten into the getting rid of the cash bail system, what we're finding is by getting people, especially with the lesser crimes, back out and back to their work and their employment, there's less recidivism. And I think that means there's less incarceration. And eventually, I think Jay's right, at first, because we usually will waive time if somebody is out of incarceration pending the trial. We're going to waive time. It may clog it for a little bit, but I think eventually, once it starts catching up, I think it will. We're going to see a decrease.
I'll jump in. I actually wanted to address Jay's point about continuances and just put this caveat. All the judges review motions to continue. So again, it goes back to judges. And as a defense attorney, I have to demonstrate good cause as to why I need a continuance. It's not simply that my client's on bond and he'd like to put this case off for about 10 years and hopefully it'll just evaporate. I have to show that, you know, I'm investigating, I'm moving forward with my case. There are reasons for this. Now, as far as this topic and bail, this all comes under the rubric, in my mind, of criminal justice reform and realignment and all of it. And there are a lot of positive changes, in my opinion, in criminal justice, where finally the system is starting to recognize some of the implicit bias that's been there for years. And one of the huge, huge problems in the criminal justice system, in my opinion, early on, and I learned this as a public defender in the early 90s, is this idea of the freedom carrot. And that's what I called it, and I had a lot of colleagues that called it that too. And you know, here you are in court, you've got an offer from the prosecutor that your client can go home, and you've got a client who says, I'm not going to take that deal because I didn't do it. And then you approach the judge and you ask them, will you OR my client? Will you let them out without bail? Since the prosecutor seems to be okay with them going home, why shouldn't he go home today, Your Honor? Routinely, that was denied. Bail stands, set for trial, client's still in custody.
Or set for a pretrial conference because a certain commissioner liked to coerce pleas that way. We won't talk about that. Jay, we have about 45 seconds.
Here's my closing thought. Our current system of cash bail is inherently unjust because it does nothing to protect victims of crime. And our state is now in the vanguard of returning justice and public safety to our system. I agree with what Garrick and other people have said. No one should be held in jail just because they cannot afford bail. And no one who presents a true and immediate threat to the public should be released just because they have money.
And that will be the last word on the subject. I'd like to thank all of you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we've been talking about our system of bail. My guests tonight are Garrett Rutgers, with offices in Redwood City, a certified criminal law specialist certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. B.J. Fadum, once a police officer and formerly working with pretrial services, Mr. Fadum is known to us now as a certified law specialist, also California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California, with offices in San Jose and Santa Rosa. And Jay Boyarski, Chief Assistant District Attorney of Santa Clara County. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us tonight. We'll return next week with Your Legal Rights, where in conjunction with the Labor and Employment section of the California Lawyers Association, we'll return to our discussion of employment law and harassment in the workplace and look forward to your individual calls and questions. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. And to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden, and most of all, our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.